From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And happy Labor Day. Hope you are lucky enough to have the labor you want and be resting from it. For the presidential campaigns, this is no day of rest. It marks the start of the final stretch of the 2020 presidential race. And with just 57 days until Election Day, it's the running mates who are campaigning, Mike Pence and Kamala Harris, stomping on opposite sides of the battleground state of Wisconsin. President Trump is in Washington, where there's continuing fallout from that report that he made disparaging remarks about the military. Let's set the table for the week ahead with Washington Post White House reporter Tolu Olorunipa. And Tolu, to that report, the White House has been denying what's now a growing number of reports, including from a Fox News reporter, confirming anonymous claims that President Trump called soldiers who lost their lives in World War II losers and suckers. You know, but the president called John McCain a loser and mocked a disabled reporter, and it didn't seem to affect his support. What's your sense of whether this is going to matter?
Yeah, it does seem like the president and his campaign think it will matter, because every time we get a new confirmation, a new news outlet confirms these allegations, the White House comes out with a new on-the-record denial by another official or former official. They've been really going all hands on deck to try to refute this story, even though we now have a large number of reputable news organizations that have confirmed it. But it's clear that this is something that the president is concerned about. He's been tweeting about it. And they do think this is something that can break through with all of the other things that the president has said and done that have seemed to sort of have been swept under the rug. This is something that strikes a chord with a lot of Americans. It's something that you do not expect to hear from a commander-in-chief disparaging the service of military members. And I think that's part of the reason they're pushing back so hard on it. And I do think this is a story that we'll continue to hear about in the coming week.
Okay, so we'll keep an ear for that. But this week, Joe Biden begins to ramp up in-person campaigning with a trip to Michigan. The president, Trump, will hold events in Florida, North Carolina, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. The president's message has been that a vaccine may be ready by the end of next month, and Democrats are to blame for unrest in the streets. Biden's message is that Trump failed in curbing COVID-19 and is sowing the hatred and violence that we see in the streets. Do we know who's resonating with voters who might, shift at all?
Yeah, the first thing I would mention is that polls show that the vast majority of Americans have already made up their minds, and we're starting to see votes start to trickle in already in places like North Carolina, where you can cast your ballot by mail already. So there's a small segment, a small sliver of the American electorate that these two campaigns are fighting over, and it seems like there are two different messages that are going out to these voters. One on law and order, which the president seems to be having the upper hand on that in terms of winning over some suburban voters, some voters who are maybe more moderate, but worried about the unrest that we've seen in various cities. The second message being on the coronavirus and COVID-19, that being a message that President Trump has failed in his handling of this. The president trying to turn this around by saying a vaccine is coming before Election Day. But it does seem like Joe Biden has the upper hand when you look at the polling on this. More voters expect him to do a better job than President Trump has done in managing the crisis, listening to the scientists, and the idea of a miracle vaccine coming, at the last minute as an October surprise before Election Day doesn't seem to be something that the American people are considering as a reality. We'll have to wait and see and determine if it actually happens. But so far, it hasn't helped the president's number that he's been peddling this idea that before Election Day, there will be this miracle cure that we'll all be able to use to vaccinate ourselves against this.
Yeah, but President Trump has the job of president, so he can take actions that send out messages. And last week, he banned racial sensitivity training in federal agencies. This is, of course, at a time of social upheaval over police violence. The head of the Office of Management and Budget sent a memo saying the president has directed me to ensure that federal agencies cease and desist from using taxpayer dollars to fund these divisive, un-American propaganda training sessions. Who is this for? I mean, it would seem like his base might already appreciate this.
Yeah, this is something that has been peddled on Fox News in the recent weeks, and the president heard about it on Fox News, and he quickly took action. And that's what, some of the people who voted for the president wanted him to do, to sort of take on these culture wars and take on this issue of race in a way that's more appealing to white people and white voters. And this could turn off a lot of minority voters. This could be something that makes it seem like the president is clearly taking a side when it comes to racial grievance, rather than trying to heal the divide. But it's something that the president has been doing for the past 3.5 years, and he's been clear about sort of siding with the members of his base and people who have supported him, even if it means sort of going into some of these murky waters of, you know, racial division where the president seems comfortable.
Interesting. You're not the only one who says that the president actually got this idea from Fox News. But real quick, less than a minute, Congress back in session. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin says there will be a deal with Democrats to help people. What's your sense of that?
Yeah, it seems like they're still very far apart. At least they seem to have a deal to keep the government open. They have two different things they have to do: keep the government open before September 30th and try to come up with some kind of relief. The first part seems like they'll be able to do it. It seems like it'll be much harder for them to come up with some kind of stimulus package or relief because they're just so far apart right now.
Yeah. Tulu Alarunipaha, White House reporter for The Washington Post. Thanks as always.
You got it. Thank you.
More schools are reopening this week, including a private academy in Sanford, Maine, run by a church where there's an outbreak of COVID-19. The leader of that church also presided over a wedding that's now linked to the state's largest outbreak of the disease. In recent church services, Pastor Todd Bell has railed against safety precautions, raising concerns among some that his school will put the community at risk. Patty White from Maine Public Radio reports.
A recent Sunday service at the Calvary Baptist Church in Sanford, Maine began with hymns. In a video that was posted online from the evening service, nearly 24 choir members file onto a stage unmasked, stand shoulder to shoulder, and sing.
That's some good congregational singing. I'm encouraged by that. The choir, we're off a little bit in numbers, but it's just a wonderful sound.
After his praise, Pastor Todd Bell then turned his attention to the criticism he faced for holding in-person services the day after the Maine Center for Disease Control announced it was investigating an outbreak of 5 cases of COVID-19 at his church. Since then, that number is up to at least 10.
But we go on. We go on with courage and boldness to the help of the Lord. What's not being reported is those that were COVID positive are finished quarantine and in church tonight. Isn't that the way it's supposed to be? In church tonight.
Bell has also come under scrutiny for officiating a wedding in Millinocket, Maine, that sparked the state's largest outbreak to date of COVID-19. It's now linked to more than 140 cases, 3 deaths, an outbreak at a nursing home, and another at the York County Jail. The Maine CDC is still investigating whether the cases at the Calvary Baptist Church are linked to the wedding. But Bell acknowledged in a recent service that 6 families went to the ceremony. He lamented to his congregation that the word investigate is being associated with the church and criticized the state for telling people what to do. Government is not the answer, Bell said. God is the answer.
As I said on a Zoom call Friday with all of the CDC head and Dr. Shaw, you're looking at a liberty lover. I love liberty.
If people want to wear a mask, Bell told his congregation, wear a mask. But he also told them using one was like trying to keep out a mosquito with a chain link fence. Bell also complained that a socialist platform is dictating when kids can go to school. The church's school, Sanford Christian Academy, starts tomorrow. The more than 70 students enrolled, Bell said, will attend 5 days a week, and all sports are a go.
And we're just going to go on with things. We're not going to be ruled by fear. We're going to be governed by faith. Can somebody give me an amen?
The pastor's comments are raising concerns in a community already reeling from an uptick in cases, says Sanford City Councilor Maura Herlihy.
The school is located in a very dense part of our community. The students come from different towns. They don't just come from Sanford. And that, you know, with the school starting and the fact that the pastor doesn't seem to want to work with the state of Maine and the CDC to keep things safe, what's the potential impact of an outbreak at the school should it occur?
Herlihy says that the Sanford police had to contact the church earlier this spring for conducting services in violation of CDC guidelines. If the school flouts safety protocols, she's not sure to what extent the city can intervene.
If, in all honesty, if the Sanford Christian Academy and Calvary Baptist are not working with the CDC, they're not going to work with the city of Sanford.
At a news briefing last week, Maine CDC Director Dr. Nirav Shah said his agency has been communicating with Pastor Bell about its expectations for compliance with safety protocols.
But we also need to make sure that it's more than just communication we're having. We need to make sure that the communication is coupled with responsive action.
Shaw stressed that his agency's goal is to work with organizations. But if safety protocols aren't followed, he said, state agencies can intervene for violating the state's executive order. Sanford Christian Academy did not respond to multiple requests for comment, but in a recent radio address, Pastor Todd Bell said that the church has secured an attorney as it defends its religious liberty. For Here and Now, I'm Patty White.
There are some incredible COVID-19 numbers coming out of India. The country recorded more than 90,000 new infections in the past 24 hours and now has the second highest coronavirus case count in the world, more than 4.2 million, second only to the United States. The BBC's Yagita Lamai joins us from Mumbai. And Yagita, these numbers, more than 90,000 new cases in just 24 hours. Is there a reason for that huge spike?
Well, I mean, we've seen these numbers sort of go up gradually, you know, since March. And India has not really ever reached a stage where it looked like the curve was flattening. And it's really what is worrying is the pace at which it's spreading. And that is a lot faster than you're seeing even in the US, which means that if India continues down this path, you know, in the coming weeks, it could become the country with the highest number of COVID-19 cases in the world. The country has also massively ramped up testing. So it's testing as many as a million samples a day. This is among the highest totals in the world. I think it's actually higher than what the US is doing as well at this point. You know, one of the things the government says is because we're testing more, we're discovering more cases, and that's why we have these sort of staggering daily figures that are coming out. But the other side of that, Robin, is that even at this rate of more than a million tests a day, it's only a very small fraction of India's 1.3 billion people who've been screened. So actually, it's possible that a lot of cases have not even been discovered yet. The system of counting deaths in India is not very watertight. Sometimes, you know, there are long delays in, you know, recording deaths. And so I think, you know, most people agree that the numbers we're even seeing out there are probably underreported. We just don't know, you know, to what extent they're underreported.
Well, you're right. I mean, with almost four times the population of the U.S., the virus doesn't discriminate. It would stand to reason that the, you know, the numbers will go up just because of the sheer numbers of people in the country. But deaths, more than 70,000 have been counted. Is there a sense that that's an undercount?
Well, I think there is definitely a sense that that's an undercount because of, you know, as I was saying, the system of counting deaths in India is not exactly watertight. Sometimes, you know, how the deaths are medically certified, you know, that would not say COVID-19. It might say a comorbidity if you had one. We don't know to what extent the deaths are not being counted. But I think, you know, one thing we can say for sure from, you know, what we've been told by public health experts, as well as what the government is saying, in fact, is that India has a low death rate, which means that the number of Indians dying of COVID-19 relative to the size of its population is a lot lower than the rate that we've seen in the US, the UK, Spain, Brazil, any of the other countries that have been badly hit. And as I said, you know, public health experts also agree with this assessment that even if you factor in the underreporting, India is seeing a low death rate. But we still don't know the science behind that. We don't know why that's happening. The thing is that if the curve continues to rise, if the virus continues to spread, even at a low death rate, because of the size of the population, that's still lives of hundreds of thousands of people at risk.
Yeah. And India did impose what's been described as the world's largest lockdown as this began. So describe that. What's going on now? Are people wearing masks, social distancing, staying at home? What's the sense?
Well, so, you know, pretty much all of the lockdown restrictions that were put in place, you know, have been eased or are in the process of being eased. You know, some of the things that have not been restarted yet are schools, colleges, universities. International travel is yet banned, especially, you know, except for some special repatriation flights. But other than that, you know, everything is opening up. In fact, the capital, Delhi, which is seeing a surge in cases, as well as many other parts of the country, have just today opened up their metro rail system, so their subway system, homes for the first time since the third week of March. And of course, there are worries that, you know, could this lead to another spike in cases? But, you know, the other thing is India's economic figures, which came out last week, showed a very sharp contraction. Of course, that was over a period of complete lockdown. But, you know, on the ground, what we're witnessing is that the economy is in crisis. And for the government, putting another lockdown in place is just not an option, because for a developing country, that kind of contraction in the economy, you know, could be the, you know, could be the difference between someone having two meals a day or one meal a day.
But again, you're saying that the restrictions have been eased, and then we see this spike of 90,000 cases. So it'll be interesting to see what happens there. The BBC's Yogita Lamai in Mumbai, India. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
To kick off the new school year, something called the New Teacher Challenge has taken off on platforms like TikTok and Twitter. But this trending challenge is not harmless. It's become the latest form of cyberbullying of people with physical disabilities. Parents tape themselves showing their children an image of their new teacher, but in reality, it's the face of a person with a physical difference. Like Melissa Blake, she's a disability activist born with a rare genetic bone and muscular disorder called Freeman-Sheldon syndrome. Melissa joins us now on Skype from her home in DeKalb, Illinois. Welcome, Melissa.
Hi, Tanya. Thanks for having me.
Yes. You know, I'm reading here that you don't even have a TikTok.
No, I don't. I feel like I'm a generation too old for TikTok, so I never got into that.
But me too.
I just started getting messages from people who follow me on Instagram and Twitter telling me I saw people using your picture on TikTok for this new prank, and I just wanted to let you know that I've reported these accounts. That's how I originally heard about it.
The mocking of your appearance is something that you've dealt with before, but you say that the bullying is getting worse online. How have you decided to fight back?
I think in a way I fight back by, being a disability activist. Sometimes it would be easier, I think, if I just said, oh, I've had enough of social media. I'm just, you know, not going to be on because it's just too many bullies. But then I think by being on there and remaining visible and sharing my story, I think I'm, in a way, saying that, you know, these bullies and cyberbullying is not going to drive me away from social media. Because I think a lot of this prank is when they use people, you know, physical differences, when they use their picture, I think a lot of it is because our society hasn't normalized disabled people and people who look different. So I feel like every time, you know, I post a selfie or I share something about my life as a disabled woman, I feel like that is representation that is going to really combat this ableism.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that really speaks to the other side of what social media can do. As you said, it normalizes people who are part of our everyday lives because we have more exposure and an understanding. Freeman-Sheldon syndrome is a genetic bone and muscular disorder, as I mentioned. You've had 26 surgeries, and this impacts your day-to-day life.
Yeah, it does. I had all my surgeries. I'm 39 now. I had my first surgery when I was 10 weeks old, and then I had my last one when I was 16. My mobility obviously is limited. I can walk, but just very short distances, so I use a wheelchair the majority of the time.
I'm just astonished by what these parents are teaching their children about difference by making this a joke for social media clicks and likes.
I wouldn't excuse it if it was like teenagers doing it. They're just teenagers. But then when I found out that it was the parents that were doing this, I thought, shouldn't they be the ones that are teaching their children that this sort of thing isn't okay? Mm-hmm. So that's what I was most shocked about, is that it was actual adults that think this is funny.
How can social media platforms like TikTok be more proactive and no longer really tolerating this form of cyberbullying? And all cyberbullying, really.
Yeah, I think it's really important, I think, because, you know, people with disabilities like myself can speak out all we want. But if these social media platforms aren't taking a proactive role to take down these videos when they see them, then my being so vocal is only going to go so far. So I think it's really important people report these videos that they are taken down.
Mm-hmm.
And I think these social media platforms have to have like a zero tolerance policy for these things.
Yeah, because initially when this came up to them, they said that this did not violate the terms of use.
Every time multiple people, when they would message me to tell me my photo was being used, they would say I reported it and TikTok told me that it doesn't violate the guidelines. And people have even sent me screenshots of TikTok saying, oh, this, it doesn't violate anything.
They have since cracked down on this. But Melissa, what is the takeaway from all of this that you want parents to know?
I think the most important thing is I've gotten messages from people that never did the challenge, but when they heard about my story, they used it as an opportunity to talk to their children. And I think use this horrible prank as an opportunity to really do something positive and, teach your children that people with disabilities aren't something to be feared.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if we have these open conversations about disabilities and about what it's like to be disabled and that people with disabilities aren't so different, I think for the next generation, they can grow up in a world where they're not afraid of people with disabilities.
That's disability activist Melissa Blake. Thank you so much for talking with us about this.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
The pandemic has left many people feeling isolated, and some have turned to alcohol and drugs, no secret there. Recreational marijuana sales in Colorado set a record high in May and June. Meanwhile, in Texas, a budding hemp industry is attracting new customers. Texas Public Radio's Dominic Anthony Walsh reports.
In Bergheim, Texas, just north of San Antonio, there's a skunky smell in the air.
You know, that's a really good description. So skunky is a very typical terpene that is in most of these plants.
Austin Ruppel is president and co-owner of Pure ISO Labs, a company that grows and sells hemp and CBD, or cannabidiol, products.
You're looking at permitted hemp in the state of Texas. We've got
he stands next to rows and rows of more than 300 plants.
So the cherry bubblegum will have a kind of a sugary, kind of a tart smell to it.
Hemp is a type of cannabis that's rich in CBD, a legal compound that does not get users high. It contains much less THC, the psychoactive component that does get you high, which is still illegal in Texas. Congress legalized hemp federally in 2018, and Texas followed suit last year. Now, this farm and others are preparing for the first ever legal cannabis harvest since the plant was banned statewide nearly a century ago.
Hello!
Hey, how's it going?
The little shop next to the farm is full of CBD products. Co-owner Jennifer Ruppel shows me the product line.
We have topicals, beverage additives, which are going to be...
Ruppel says demand for these products has crept up since the COVID-19 pandemic began. But why? She chooses her words carefully.
So you get just an enhanced benefit, let's say, from it. So that's kind of the difference there.
She's cautious because the U.S. Food and Drug Administration has only recognized CBD for certain uses, like treatment of epilepsy. But when Ruppel says enhanced benefit, well, what are the benefits? Can CBD, as many claim, actually help with anxiety?
Yeah, so it's definitely still up in the air. And I think it's, obviously people are theorizing that CBD might be helpful for anxiety, but there's not really any good data yet, any high-quality data.
Kent Hutchison is a professor of psychology and neuroscience at the University of Colorado Boulder. He and his colleagues are working on a long-term observational study on how CBD and THC affect anxiety. But an observational study won't generate as high-quality data as a clinical trial would.
If we were to do an actual clinical trial, it becomes much, much more difficult given the regulatory hurdles that we have to deal with.
Regulatory hurdles pop up because cannabis is still a Schedule I drug at the federal level, the most regulated category for high-risk drugs with no medical use.
So we have a very Janus-faced relationship with CBD and with cannabis in general when it comes to mental health issues and what the therapeutic possibilities could be and what the cultural baggage still is around this.
Martin A. Lee is the author of Smoke Signals, A Social History of Marijuana. And he's the founder of Project CBD, a nonprofit that promotes cannabis science and therapeutics.
for centuries, humankind has had a connection with the plant, but because of marijuana prohibition, we lost that connection, and we're in the process of relearning that today.
In Texas, the process of relearning is happening slowly. This first crop of hemp will be smaller than many expected, and in late July, growers received more bad news when the state announced a ban on smokable hemp. So while the pandemic may have increased demand for CBD products, it's unclear if hemp farmers in Texas will be able to meet it. For Here and Now, I'm Dominic Anthony Walsh.
There's a new version of the autobiography of Malcolm X coming out this week, and a familiar voice reading this new audiobook, Oscar-nominated actor Lawrence Fishburne. Here's a little bit from the beginning.
When my mother was pregnant with me, she told me later, a party of Ku Klux Klan riders galloped to our home in Omaha, Nebraska one night. Surrounding the house, brandishing their shotguns and rifles, they shouted for my father to come out. My mother went to the front door and opened it. Standing where they could see her pregnant condition, she told them that she was alone with her three small children and that my father was away preaching in Milwaukee.
As told to Alex Haley, the autobiography of Malcolm X was published in October of 1965, 8 months after the civil rights activist and former Nation of Islam spokesperson was assassinated. Lawrence Fishburne joins me now. And Lawrence, what was the process of reading the words of such an iconic figure like Malcolm X?
It's so funny that you should ask that. You know, I have been doing what I do most of my life now. And I think everything in my professional life has prepared me for this, if that makes any sense.
Did you listen to Malcolm X's speeches as part of your preparation, those types of things?
I listened to a little bit of his speeches, not too much, but just enough. I have to say that working with Nicole Shelton, who directed me in this, was really, she was really the most valuable asset that I had. You know, the book is 600 plus pages. It's a lot. It's a lot of words, a lot of language. It's a lot of stories and history. And, you know, she has incredible ears. So she was a very active listener. And part of the process was, you know, we'd start in the morning and we'd talk for about 30 minutes, you know, just about Malcolm and his journey and his experiences and his stories and his relationship to Alex and his determination to educate himself, all kinds of things. And then we'd start working.
Yeah, I wondered if you had Alex Haley in mind when you were taping this as well, because of that relationship that he had with Malcolm X as he was writing these words.
Yeah, I did. I mean, you know, he recorded a lot of this in Alex's tiny apartment somewhere in the village. They didn't know each other before. And Malcolm expressed his, you know, slight mistrust.
Right. He had to gain his trust. Yeah.
You know, they had to really develop that relationship over time. You know, Alex has an afterword that he wrote that unfortunately isn't a part of this recording. But in it, he talks about the idea of gaining Malcolm's trust and about the time that it took for him to relax and the various emotional states that Malcolm would be in when they were involved in these interviews, I guess. So that was also very helpful.
In listening to it, there were scenes that jumped out to me in ways that didn't when you read it on the page. Were there surprises or really maybe the better word is revelations that you had while reading it?
Okay. That tells me I might have done my job well.
Yeah.
What was one of those things that stood out in particular?
Oh, you know, so I'll tell you a little bit. I went to a park and laid out in the grass and listened. And Malcolm talking about himself as a child and growing up in mid-Michigan and Lansing and going to Lansing. And I could visually see those places in Boston and Roxbury. There was just a painting of a picture that I saw. But for you, were there any things that stood out to you that you didn't really see, but now that you were reading these words, came clear for you?
No, there were several things. You know, obviously very striking is the way in which Malcolm's father died. The setting of what must have been that that library at that prison that he wound up in. The ballroom in Boston that he used to dance at.
Mm-hmm.
Those are some of the things that kind of jumped out at me on this mm-hmm. reading.
Well, let's hear more from the audiobook. This is you as Malcolm X talking about his father's death.
Negroes in Lansing have always whispered that he was attacked and then laid across some tracks for a streetcar to run over him. His body was cut almost in half. He lived 2.5 hours in that condition.
Lawrence, what a time for this to come out, right?
Yeah. Yeah, what a time. I have been very encouraged by what I'm seeing in terms of the Black Lives Matter movement and the various corporations and companies that have been calling for change, and the NBA and the WNBA and other athletes. And this, you know, this pending election, the attempts at voter suppression that are going on as we speak. Not that I'm encouraged by that, mind you. I'm just
it's
saying
it's a part of the moment. Absolutely.
It's a part of the moment, and it's one of those things that we have to really, really be, you know, we have to be watchful. You know, these things that have been going on with the post office. We have to be on our game. We have to be on our A game. If the country is going to self-correct, that means all of us have to participate, whether we think it's or not. Excuse my mm-hmm. French.
Mm-hmm. You know, Lawrence, I want to touch on your expansive career for a moment. I did a little survey with my people on what movies they remember you most from, yeah. and everyone said something different. Apocalypse Now, Boys in the Hood, The Matrix. Yeah. It doesn't even really do your career justice for me to try to lay out your work. But one of the first roles, Earl and Me, where you played Cornbread, a young man who witnessed a police officer shoot and kill a basketball star. And right. I'm just thinking about the depth of that story in light of the moment that we're in right now and this reckoning with police brutality. Yeah. Do you often think about that, about that connection there?
Well, I have, yeah. I mean, lately, of course, because, you know, I just had a piece come out called Free Ray Sean. I don't know if you're aware of it.
Mm.
But it came out on this new platform called Quibi. It's a similar story. It deals with what we're dealing with in this moment. So, you know, this is a story that I've been telling since 1972. Sadly, it continues to need to be told and dramatized. And the hope is that in doing so, we will, you know, illuminate the humanity of everybody that's involved in these kind of incidents and, you know, find the courage to come together and talk and, you know, reason with each other and try and figure out a way to rectify these problems.
You've been working since you were like 11, 12 years old.
It's 10 years old. So, yeah, it'll be 50 years next year.
50 years next year. You have such an expansive career and you have so much more ahead. All of these projects and the work that you're doing. Where do you see yourself as you think about the future of your career and what you want for it?
Well, I see myself directing and writing and producing more. Of course, acting is my first love, and I hope to be blessed enough to continue to do that for as long as possible. I've just recently gotten back into a writing practice, so I'm anxious to see what comes out.
What kind of writing? Like fiction, just, nonfiction?
I'm just writing again. We'll see what comes out. I've been very blessed to be able to do what I do. I found what I love early in life, which makes me doubly blessed. I just hope to continue to do things that, you know, entertain people and educate them as well.
Mm-hmm. Malcolm X was, of course, assassinated in 1965. It's a big question I'm about to ask you, but what do you think he would have thought of this time that we're in and the messages from his autobiography?
I think Malcolm's position would be, I hate to say I told you so, but I told you so.
Right.
Obviously, he would have, you know, he would have been much more eloquent than that, and he would have said something much more powerful. But, you know, to distill it down to, you know, the basic reality of where we are, I think he would have been like, this is what I've been talking about. This is what I've been telling people. This is what I've been trying to say, that we live under a system of racial inequality in this country. And it's a trick that has not only been played on Black people, but it's been played on all people. that we should be fearful and mistrustful of each other, and that our differences are somehow more important than our similarities.
Lawrence Fishburne reads the new audiobook version of the autobiography of Malcolm X. Lawrence, thank you so much for this conversation.
You are very welcome.
A new Labor Day mural in Chicago honors four essential workers during this pandemic: Korea Hayden, a postal worker; Juan Burrell, a school lunchroom manager at Chavez Elementary; Veronica Sanchez, a nanny and leader with Latino Union of Chicago; and Maggie Zelinska, who cleans homes and is also a caregiver and is involved with the groups Arise Chicago and the National Domestic Workers Alliance to advocate for more protections on the job. Maggie, first, congratulations on being part of this beautiful mural. Is that appropriate? Do you feel it's an honor?
Yes, I am very honored to be representing the essential workers, not only in Chicago, but across America. I'm very honored.
Well, it's a mural on Milwaukee Ave and Hubbard Street, painted by local artist Sam Kirk, funded by the National Domestic Workers Alliance. You know, reminding people to say thank you to workers like you, honoring, as we said, a postal worker, a nanny, a lunchroom manager at a school. You know, it's one thing to have people smile at you as they pass a mural, but tell us a little bit about what your life has been like working during a pandemic.
When pandemic hit mid-March, all my cleaning jobs were put on hold, and my life is just like flashed before me. What am I going to do financially? The only job I had left, I took part-time elderly care, which I really didn't want to. So I was very, very thankful that at least I have that part-time elderly, which was 2 days a week, 4 hours, at $13 an hour. So you can imagine what my weekly income was. It was like around $100 a week. In a way, I was relieved that I didn't have to go to work to protect myself and my son. I'm a single mom with a 12-year-old. Mm. But then again, you really worry about the income and how you're going to pay the bills.
How did you pay the bills?
Well, I had plans for this year. This was my year to travel. So I was about to pay the rest of my credit cards, which was about $2,500, and I had the money to pay it. But then in mid-March, I had to put the payment on hold because I wanted to save the cash, and good that I did, because with no income, I had to use that money to just pay the, you know, electric and purchase food. I got extra gloves. And thank goodness I got like extra gloves and stuff, because now when I go to the store and I want to buy extra right now, they have none. So I'm at my last box to use for my gloves for my work. Mm.
Christina Coleman, who's a spokeswoman for the National Domestic Workers Alliance, is saying, you know, this is great that suddenly in the last several months, essential workers are suddenly visible. You know, it's nice to have the mural honoring them. But what about, you know, increasing pay standards, for instance? You know, what do you say to that? I'm sure you have a good relationship with your clients, but, you know, would you like to see more things like paid vacations and the kinds of things that other workers enjoy?
I think it wasn't really about the money. It was about the respect, because I don't think a lot of people realizes that when we come and take care of your children, your elderly, when we come to your home, you are able to go to work yourself. Basically, when I go to work, I get paid. When I don't go to work or when my job is canceled, I really don't get the money. So I had to bring my son to work, and I'm already starting to hear from my elderly. I have a couple elderly people I go to clean houses, that my son needs to stay outside. He can't come in the house inside because they're scared for their safety. Even though he wears a mask, they don't want him in the house. So that starts to become a problem for me, because now there is no school. which I'm okay with that because I want him to be protected. I don't want him to sit 8 hours in a mask. But then again, I need to go to work and do my job. The other problem we have, sometimes people don't realize when you cancel at the last minute, let's say I have a house to clean tomorrow, you don't realize that even though you say sorry, and we appreciate that you say sorry, but when you say sorry, I cannot say sorry to my electric bill, phone bill, or car payment, or mortgage. You know, I still need to pay those bills, and I can't say sorry, I don't have the money. So it's a struggle.
Well, Maggie Zielinska, first of all, I'm so glad you have Labor Day off, even though I know that, you know, you had far too many days off during the pandemic. And I hope you get some well-deserved rest. And I thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you so much. It's an honor and pleasure. Thank you.
Quick note, thank you to all of the essential workers on the Here and Now clock today, including public radio journals around the country, and also to listeners who make our labor possible. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.